You're listening to the Hybrid Cloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to hybrid cloud with your host, Andre Tost.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hybrid Cloud Podcast. Today's guest is Kevin Studley. First of all, thanks a lot for joining us today, Kevin.
Oh, my pleasure, Andre.
Kevin is an IBM fellow. He's the CTO of the IBM Z platform, which, in case you didn't know, is our mainframe. And he also acts as a VP of development for a bunch of things on the mainframe. And I'm sure he can tell us more about what that means. So let's start, as always, with introductions. Maybe if you can tell us a bit about your professional background, your history, kind of how did you get to where you are today, and maybe describe your current job to us.
I'm a almost 35-year veteran of IBM. I started in 1988 working on optimizing compilers in at that time, the IBM Toronto Lab, now the IBM Markham Lab, and actually working on the x86 platform at that time. So I'm not a heritage mainframe person. I'm a reinvented mainframer for some 8 years now, although probably like every IBMer, I've been in orbit around the mainframe platform, kind of like a comet that periodically comes into close contact with it. And then,
you know what, believe it or not, I started in 89. I have never come anywhere close to a mainframe in my entire career. So,
well,
there are exceptions to the rule.
Of course, every time you swipe a card somewhere, you're figuratively coming very near to a mainframe.
Right. Of course. I mean, job wise.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. And that's what I tell my kids, and it is one of those platforms that is, I think it's kind of like the machine behind the curtain for many people. Even the references you hear to mainframe in the movies are almost always nothing at all to do with what a mainframe really is. You know, The Matrix, the most conspicuous example, perhaps, of that. But in any case, I spent quite a bit of time in my early years just doing very deep technical work and living kind of at the interface between the hardware and the software. So I was doing, as I said, back-end optimizing code generation and compiler work, working closely with CPU architects to do, instruction set architecture design, using my knowledge and insight gained from compiling workloads. And I have some background in hardware from school as well, and working with those sort of co-design, hardware software co-design that kind of emerged out of the RISC era, perhaps maybe the only compelling long-term innovation that came out of the RISC era is the close cooperation needed between CPU designers and compiler implementers to really get the most out of hardware and to get, to evolve together those two types of technologies. And that's continued to this day, even with CISC architectures like the mainframe or IBM Z. I'm in Canada, and so to me, it's IBM Z. But in any case, I did that with mostly the what you would call the imperative languages. And then I guess came to a bit of a pause point in my career. And this new thing called Java was emerging. And I hooked up with a small startup that we'd bought that needed a compiler for their Java implementation. They had an interpreter-only solution that was running in embedded space. They were originally a Smalltalk vendor, and they needed a compiler to compete with their nearest competitor who was touting some performance advantages. And so I was sort of at a crossroads, and I decided to dive in. And that really, I would say, was the second golden age of my career. And I ended up sort of single-handedly writing an awful lot of code because it was a team of me, and redesigning from scratch a JIT compiler to help out their implementation. And
that resonates with me because Java was ultimately what brought me to the US from Europe. And I remember starting work on the JDK 0.8, I think, at the time.
The before time, yeah. Back in the time of the Sun Classic VM. And actually, that classic, non-type safe garbage collecting VM was the source of a lot of opportunity for IBM, but then ultimately an awful lot of technology mismatch and technical debt, and really made it difficult for us to do the kinds of things, at least in the enterprise with Java, that we wanted to do. And so it actually came to pass that this technology and this small startup that I had been working with, we had acquired them, but they were in a bit of an arm's length relationship, a little bit like Red Hat today, I would say. And so that actually emerged and became ultimately the strategic Java implementation across all of our platforms in those days, the x86 platforms, and then Power and S390 or IBM Z. And so by virtue of that work and by creating legit infrastructure that was used for that and then for some other compilers, I became an IBM fellow in 2004. And I guess the thing to say that happened a little bit before that is I also became a third line manager of the whole compiler team in Toronto. And so I was simultaneously being a distinguished engineer and a director of about 300 people. So that was a very interesting experience. And actually, I learned an awful lot about technology in that time frame, but also about managing large teams and just what it's like to be a line executive in IBM. And then I guess we did a bit of a reorganization and a lot of that technology moved to the Rational brand from what had been the WebSphere brand. And ultimately, over the course of the next, I guess, 10 years or so, I ultimately became the CTO of Rational. And then Rational, with the disintegration of Software Group and another reorg, I had the opportunity to do a bunch of different roles. And I chose to work in IBM Z, where for the first time in a long time, all of the software, middleware, languages, operating systems, hypervisors relevant to the platform and the actual hardware roadmap and teams came together under the same general manager organization. And I thought that was quite a powerful opportunity. And so jumped into doing that role as the CTO. So I guess I've just in the past probably 15 years just taken on ever increasing breadth CTO roles, now crossing both hardware and software. And that's sort of where I am today. The VP of operating systems role, which actually I've just changed out of that role, came kind of as an executive left the business on short notice. And my boss just asked me to help. He'd known I'd led some larger organizations in the past. And so for the last 5 months, I've been sort of a steward of the ZOS operating system, the Linux operating system, the virtual, the hypervisors, you know, for the platform, as well as a lot of technology like OpenShift and the add-ons. That was an interesting retracement, I guess. And I learned how to de-atrophy a bunch of management muscles that I'd allowed to, I guess, become less active in my life. And so that was very interesting. But now we've reorganized again, and I still am the CTO of the platform, but I'm also managing the program management for delivering the hardware. So that's a new excitement for me. And that's what really gets me going, is learning new things. As you can see, I'm somewhat impatient to reinvent myself from time to time. And I keep saying, you know, if you don't have enough butterflies in your stomach when you change jobs, you're probably not taking enough risk. And I think maybe I'm getting insensitized to butterflies. So, you know, better be careful with my choices in the future.
It's obviously great if you're in an environment where you can do that, where you have that choice or that option, right, to move from one area to another. There's a bunch of questions that I have about what you tie, and all of them seem to be about balancing, kind of like you said, being a manager and a technical person. How do you decide where you spend your time, right? And then again, this somewhat resonates with me because I never thought I would, but I became a manager not too long ago. And now I find out things about HR issues in far corners of the world that I never knew existed, right? And the question always is that something that I should spend my time on, right? And so I wonder if you have any comments on that.
I mean, I think first line managers may be among the hardest and least appreciated jobs, you know, in IBM. It's a powerful and important role. I mean, powerful in the sense that we do so much better when our first line managers are doing a great job. And part of that job is kind of protecting their employees from a lot of swirl that's going on around them. And it can be a little bit thankless at times, if I'm being honest. But there's a lot of things you can take pride in when you're leading a team and their accomplishments and seeing them grow and develop and move on to bigger and better things, and, you know, being a part of their development, you know, similar to the way it is with your family when you see those things emerge from, you know, in your children, you take that sense of responsibility. So I can't claim to be excellent at balancing things, and if my wife were here, she'd be the first to tell me that I could use a little work on that front at times. But what I will say is no one's going to help you with that if you can't help yourself on it. So finding that line that works for you, and I think it's different for everybody, is is important. I do think it's a very powerful combination to take technical depth and breadth and a technical background and marry it with line management. And I think we see that in the existing CEO in Arvind, where he's remained extremely technical, much more technical than I think our previous two CEOs, at least. And, you know, as capable as they were, it's a different set of strengths that he brings to the table. And it's very timely, given the rate and pace of change in the marketplace and the emergence and relevance of big, gnarly technical problems like AI and cloud computing, that he's so deep. And so I honestly think it's a very important aspect of your kind of quiver of arrows to develop.
As you just mentioned cloud, and I want to get there, but let me ask you something else first, and maybe that's going to lead us there. So like I said, I've never really worked on the mainframe itself. I don't think I've ever logged into one, to be honest. But I know a lot of people who do, right? And it turns out that most people working on the mainframe that I know have become fairly loyal to that platform. They're all passionate about it. But it seems that, unfortunately, they're always quickly pushed into a defensive role where people say, like, but aren't mainframes old? Don't we all want to get rid of mainframes? And then the answer is, oh, no, quite the contrary, right? And what then comes is usually an argument over there's a lot of existing programs written in languages like COBOL that basically run, for example, the banks of this world, right? And banks are very hesitant to touch that. But then there's also this, and so this is what I'm leading to, this another balancing question. There's also this notion of, you just said, we can now run containers on a mainframe, right? We can run Linux on a mainframe. And so how do you balance also in terms of where you put your investment and your development in, like catching up with all the new stuff that's there, or kind of continue to optimize on the existing footprint and make sure that never goes away?
Well, you have to do a little of both. You know, to be honest, it is a very sticky platform. If you've got 220 million lines of COBOL in production using, you know, proprietary middleware and databases to solve a problem like core banking, which is a pretty common number in a large bank, you know, worldwide, just think about the challenge even of just going perfectly sideways and trying to recreate the same thing in another technology stack, even if it were possible.
But now often paired with the problem that a lot of people who wrote that code aren't here anymore.
Yeah, but code is understandable, and we have tools to help with that. That's not a non-problem for sure, but it's not going to be helped by throwing it all out and starting from scratch, honestly.
Right.
And it's just, you know, the sizing of that is infeasible. I'm not making up this number, 220 million. You know, that's a real number from a real customer. And if you just imagine the project to rewrite, even if you had a lot of automated assistance, and then really what you're doing is going sideways on functionality, probably you're going backwards on maturity and stability, and you would be moving to a realm where some of the things that you've taken for granted on the platform are not in play. So, you know, you can view a mainframe essentially as an architected and engineered system for running a certain set of important workload types better than any other hardware or software combination platform can run them. And Apple, paradoxically, has popularized this notion with their M1 and M2 designs, which are system-on-a-chip designs, which are very closely focused, I think, developed out of their own experience in mobile, where, you know, you can't afford to put commodity stuff on that platform. You can't afford the extra battery life in a mobile. So you pretty quickly figure out what you need to do well and what you don't need to do. They don't need to have big, beefy processors with large caches to run databases. That's what we have on our system. You know, they need energy efficient cores with video acceleration and other types of accelerators. We need sort, compression, encryption, decimal computation accelerators, AI inference accelerators, you know, for real-time inference. They don't necessarily need those things. You look at an M1, instead of having 28 fairly weak Intel cores, and I'm not sure anybody does 28 things at once on a laptop, they have 8 larger cores that give you better response time and a set of accelerators that are focused particularly on that space. So, you know, it's interesting that they've actually popularized this notion. We've been doing it for 60 years. And so there's no software that I'm aware of that doesn't like very high performance, single thread performance cores with, you know, 5.2 gigahertz, probably 15 times the cache of any other competing core per hardware thread, a potent set of accelerators, including full IO offload. There's not much software that doesn't like an environment like that, but it's only really mission critical, transactional, and data serving workloads that really need it. that are truly differentiated by having it. And that's what those workloads are doing, you know, in the back ends of banks and insurance companies, large government, automotive, telco, you know, pretty much every major industry and every geography around the world. And the platform's growing. If you look at the momentum, ever since I got into this job, we published a chart showing greater than 3x growth in installed capacity in the past decade. And that's been for, well, at least for the last 6 years now. So even a little bit, not quite for the whole duration of this role. And if you do the math on that, 16 years at that growth rate, which is 3x over a decade. So do your 16th power of a 10th root and you get something like 7x, you know, installed growth over the last 16 years. That's a pretty good trajectory. And it shows you that these workloads aren't going away. In fact, kind of corroborates that these are the workloads that run the increasingly digitized world. And it does so because it's really good at those workloads. And it's not just the scale and performance. It's the security. It's the resiliency. You know, all of those things put together make it an ideal platform for those kind of workloads. So it's not really, although it's a big number in people's IT budget, we also are familiar with quite a few clients who've done this analysis that shows, well, it is 7 to 10% of our IT budget in a given year, but it's doing 70% of the work. So that makes it efficient at that scale. Now, if your workload fits on a laptop, buy a laptop. But if you can, you know, if you can justify the scale of an IBM Z machine and you have that kind of service level agreement and requirements, you're maybe in a regulated industry, there's sort of no better solution for you out there. And that's why it's, you know, it's been around for so long. And, you know, as a local advertiser want to say around here, you know, you can't be out to lunch on price for 25 years in a row and still be in business. And that's similar the case for us. You know, you can't be out to lunch on price, performance and value for 60 years and still be in business. You know, the industry would move on without us.
There's another point that I heard you mentioned virtualization a couple of times and hypervisors. And that's another thing I've heard from mainframe people, you know, when we talk about virtualization in terms of, you know, when it came with like virtual machines. And I think of now containers as a form of virtualization as well, right? Making efficient use of the underlying compute power. And mainframe experts would usually say, we invented virtualization. In fact, we invented it before you were born, kind of thing, right? So is there still a lot of evolution happening in that space?
That's a glass that's half full, in my opinion, as well as half empty. So did a lot of these concepts get invented in the mainframe of that context? Absolutely. There are, in fact, two levels of virtualization implemented in the machine, and the machine actually even has hardware to accelerate the performance of the second level guest, whereas most hardware is only going to have to worry about a first level guest. So the classic x86 scenario where you have, say, VMware or KVM running on the metal and say a Linux image running above that or a number of Linux images, that's what would be considered a first level guest. You know, we have to deal with second level guests because we also have a partitioning technology called LPAR, which implements virtualization there. However, so yeah, we invented all that stuff, but we stopped short of delivering what I would call a delightful management experience. And so the real innovation I think that VMware brought was around the management and the operational experience of using virtual machines at scale in an enterprise. And so, you know, to our shame, we didn't figure out, you know, that story and create, you know, an equivalent technology for many years. Yeah. And as for containers, like that is a very valid point. I think the other value proposition of containers is that encapsulation of configuration so that the upper levels of the container stack express what they need from the lower levels and you don't have to have this, what we have sometimes a problem where there's a kind of an implicit contract between the way the middleware perhaps is configured and the way the applications are expecting it to be configured. And in a containerized world, you know, by this so-called, I guess I call it the transportability promise, you know, you have something very generic in the container, say it might be something like CoreOS or at the very bottom. And then all the specialization occurs in the container stack above successively, you know, up to the top where the application talks about which version of Python, say, that it requires, which talks about which version of the operating system it requires, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't have to get all that right yourself. The container stack's going to tell you all that stuff when it starts to get loaded. And that's a very valuable encapsulation of configuration, because that's a big problem on our platform, which essentially is a field of snowflakes, every one different.
It reminds me of a conversation I had with a friend the other day where we're now, and I've looked at it. I haven't done much with it yet, but now there's the ability to run a virtual machine in a container.
Yeah,
so, and also we're adding layers upon layers, and they even mix and match, right? So,
well, and it's a recognition that one size doesn't fit all, I think, and that, you know, virtual machines are an enduring part of the infrastructure. And actually, I think it's very valuable that, for example, OpenShift brings a set of operational controls and processes around virtual machine management that, honestly, KVM itself and the Linux stack don't really have. So I think that's actually quite valuable. It makes it much more consumable by the enterprise. So I quite like that direction, honestly. Not that it should be the only direction, but I like that direction of integrating virtual machines into the world of containers.
And since you mentioned the management plane earlier, and I feel like, and I'm a bit biased, right? Because I'm a big fan of Kubernetes and so forth. I feel like it has brought us a level of standard, a de facto standardization of the control plane interface, right? To say there's a standard language, there's an API you can call to manage, frankly, all kinds of resources, right? And that actually gets me to my next point, which is cloud. Of course, we finally arrived at the cloud, right? Because that's also what a lot of people, and we've had many conversations in this podcast about this, is what makes cloud cloud is the ability to now control things programmatically, right? To allocate things, to deallocate them, right? To plug them into each other. And now I feel like there's no surprise that Kubernetes is so popular to be run in a cloud, because it picks up right on that, right? So how does the mainframe play into all that?
Well, for one thing, I mean, you know, in my formulation or narrative about hybrid cloud, you know, cloud is never a place almost. I mean, if I'm going to talk about a particular instance, you know, the public cloud or a hyperscaler, but cloud is much more about a set of technologies, a set of skills, a set of operational processes, perhaps a way of paying and dealing with elasticity, but almost never an actual place. So cloud, and you will hear similar to the narrative around we invented virtualization, you will hear this, we invented cloud, mainframe's been a cloud in a box forever. I actually kind of discount that. There's a truth there they're trying to express, but it's not really relevant to the modern, you know, narrative around cloud, which, as you say, is very much centered around the Kubernetes control plane and you know, things like IaaS and PaaS. So first of all, on our Linux platform, you can do cloud computing just like you can do it anywhere else. So OpenShift runs there, the, you know, containers work there, cryo compliant containers, et cetera, that whole world exists on Linux. Then what we've done on the ZOS side is two things. One thing is similar to what you see in the Microsoft Windows world. We've taken and created a VirtIO compliant container for a Linux container stack and put it inside a ZOS address space. So basically, ZOS is spoofing KVM underneath, and, you know, just the same containers that you would run on Linux on Zed, you can run within a ZOS address space, and that has a lot of advantages. One, it's a very convenient way to bring the whole open source ecosystem to the platform, which otherwise would be a very exotic port for a lot of this code, and essentially would probably never happen. But it also allows us to confer some of the advantages around workload management, around high availability and disaster recovery to those workloads, and to give them tremendous latency affinity to ZOS resident, you know, backend systems of record that they might be in communication with. And now, instead of going out over fiber and communicating via HTTP, they're actually going out over shared memory internal network. You know, no programming changes, but we cut off the network stack at the bottom and just use shared memory communications to get to and fro. And that affords you some tremendous advantages. And then the final thing we're doing, similar to what Microsoft did with Windows, is we're actually investing in the operating system to introduce the things that are needed to implement containers that are native to the platform. So union file systems, you know, namespaces, et cetera, that are the basis for, you know, container. Containers are really just a an aggregation, if you like, of a bunch of capabilities in Linux that have existed for some time. They're just like a formalization of how you use those things, and a very valuable one. I'm not trying to downplay the insight there, but they're based on a set of core properties of an operating system that, you know, any operating system could implement. Now, it's quite a lot of work for us to do it, but, you know, we'll be delivering those. So now you'll have that containers experience. You'll be able to work with the Kubernetes or the OpenShift control plane across all of those aspects of the platform. And that allows us, along with some of the other investments we've made around cloud native development and bringing the new languages to the platform, to really deliver that unified common operations and development experience that you're used to from any cloud environment you're working in, CI/CD pipelines and so on, and use that to do COBOL development on the mainframe, or Node.js development on the mainframe, or Python, or what have you. And, you know, so we have a very, I think, rich and comprehensive story of how it's IBM Z and cloud. That's what hybrid cloud is in when IBM Z is a part of it.
I mean, what you just said, I mean, that makes sense to me in terms of running containers natively. I feel like if you come from a perspective of saying that's the unifying abstraction layer is at the Kubernetes layer, then you can might as well cut out the middleman, right? And run it on bare metal, right? And I'm somewhat surprised that's been around for a while, but it's still kind of maturing, I think, is my impression, right? I haven't heard many of the companies I work with saying like, we run containers on bare metal and that's the way forward. That's still kind of an exploratory area, it seems.
Yeah, and I guess the value there will come out or not. As things go forward. But fortunately, that's kind of an equalizing experience for most platforms. Everybody's got bare metal.
And to add to that, I mean, lately, obviously, with the rise of the large language models and other things like that, now a word that you hear, that you read in every article now is GPU, right? So they, again, specialized hardware for specific workloads, which leads me to another point I was curious to hear your comment about is the whole hardware side of things, right? Because you said you're both on the software side, on the hardware side, right? I feel like I have a good grasp about kind of the evolutions on the software side. How do you make sure that the hardware stays aligned with the needs of that, right? I mean, so what goes into driving the future roadmap of the hardware platforms, for example?
Well, we have the luxury in IBM of having a vertically integrated stack at some level. Not to say that we own all of those technology points, but we're active in innovating there. So everything from the silicon process research that we do up to the actual custom silicon that we do in terms of the chips and the design of the system, the virtualization, the firmware, the operating system, you know, the middleware, the language environments, the whole software stack is an area that we have the ability to innovate across that stack. We have no center of gravity where if we want to do something, we're kind of like NVIDIA, they're sort of stuck at one end of the PCI bus. Literally, right? If they want to innovate with their GPUs and now they've introduced, you know, DPUs, they are where they are. So if something would be better placed, cache coherent with the cores doing compute, they're across the PCI bus from there. And yeah, there's coherent protocols being introduced, but you know, there's a latency there that kind of hems them in to some degree. So our recent foray into the world of AI is kind of, I think, a good example of where we can work at our best in this integrated or sort of vertically integrated environment, meaning that, so we looked at our workloads and our customers and their needs and our abilities to put things in the silicon. And we recognized that we could implement a very capable, high volume, low latency inference accelerator in our hardware platform. And if we would be a CPU vendor like Intel, that would kind of be where the innovation would stop. We would put that in the hardware and then we would evangelize the rest of the industry to come in and consume it. And probably we'd contribute to a bunch of open source projects to try to exploit our particular hardware.
Which is exactly what Intel does, right?
It's what they do. And it's a capable process and they have a lot of experience at doing it. However, in our case, where we don't have access to the build it and they will come story, we don't just stop with innovating in the hardware, and you know, we expose it and virtualize it We put the support in the operating system. We bring our own AI stack there, but we also enable the open ecosystem. I guess, fortunately, at the same time, there's an emerging standard called ONNX, the Open Neural Network Exchange, which allows you to take a model trained anywhere, express it as ONNX. So choose TensorFlow, choose PyTorch, scikit-learn. I don't know, XGBoost, not a good example, but most of these frameworks can generate ONNX models. So, you know, we were able to basically deliver what we consider a frictionless AI experience, which says, we're not about training, we're about inference. And by the way, the pendulum has swapped there now. 2 years ago, 80% of the work on AI that was going on was training. And that's why you hear GPU, 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 because that's what's appropriate there. That pendulum or seesaw has flipped over now, such that much more than 50% is now spent on inference. I'm trying to put a model to work to go after a business opportunity, to save me money, to do something that's delivering business value, whatever it might be, understanding natural language and implementing a bot that I can communicate better with my users, whatever that might be. And so, you know, very timely for us, and I always say, you know, better to be lucky than good. I think we were kind of both. We delivered this inference accelerator and the message that says, do your data science the way you've been doing it. Don't change anything. Same tools, same process. Just deploy your model to ONNX and put it through our tool chain on the platform and deploy it in transactions. So now with 6 lines of COBOL, I can deploy a sophisticated deep learning model that does anti-payment fraud, because that's what I'm doing. I'm bringing AI inference to the transactional gravity that exists on the platform. It's making money transfers. It needs to do anti-money laundering analysis. It needs to do anti-fraud analysis, and it needs to do them at scale. So we worked with the largest credit card companies, the largest banks in the world. We can deal completely with their scale. And our sort of defining example is when we went to a bank who was able to basically use off-platform means, you know, calling out to an off-platform GPU, you know, probably attached to some Hadoop cluster that's going to do their anti-fraud analysis for them. They could only score 20% of their transactions because most of the time it just doesn't answer in time, can't meet their SLA at the volume that they're working at. And when they would use our AI inference accelerator and the in-transaction cache coherent with the transaction that's making that decision, they're able to score 100% of their transactions with a 1 millisecond SLA, which is what they need.
So we've come to the end of our time, and I always say, here's my last question. In this case, I have to admit, I'm almost hesitant to ask it because I feel like many of the things you've been describing fit the bill of really cool stuff, right? Because my question is there anything particularly cool and exciting that you're working on right now that kind of gets you flowing in the morning where you can't wait to get your hands on it?
Wow. So many things. When you have a broad CTO job like this, you know, it's hard to get deep time, but you get a lot of little snippets of cool time. So some of it's working on things like quantum safe cryptography and fully homomorphic encryption. The container stuff isn't done yet that I talked about, and that's a pretty exciting endeavor. I always like to go back to my roots with the languages, so I'm really excited about the ideas of bringing JIT compilation to some environments that probably haven't seen it in, I think, in an elite fashion before, perhaps Python, perhaps SQL query optimization. So for me, there's just a very full palette and plate of these opportunities that I get to dabble in every day. And accelerating foundation models in our next hardware, these kind of things are a daily kind of experience. So that's what makes me excited about coming to work, honestly.
It sounds like a pretty exciting place to be, for sure. We've run out of time, so I want to thank you for being here with us today. It was very insightful.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for asking me. It's a lot of fun.
All right, great. So with that, we're gonna wrap it up for today. Thank you all for listening in, and hope to see you all soon again. Bye-bye.